tuned to Tidings, and this is Hazel Kahn. My guest today is Nancy Stout, author of One Day in December, a brilliantly researched biography of Celia Sanchez, a major figure in Cuba's revolution. Celia is a fascinating, complex woman who is not well known in this country, but now perhaps she will be. In Cuba, though, she is a heroine, credited with being Fidel's second in command, if not his equal. Nancy Stout, I look forward to having you enlighten us so we in this country can know at least some of what the Cubans know. Welcome, Nancy.
Such a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I do want you to tell us why you came to write this book and also, you know, how you went about it. But first, could you just give us a brief history lesson? The Cuban Revolution took a long time to come to fruition, ending with that famous victory march on Havana, where people actually carried the mariposa flower as their symbol. But when did the revolution actually start? Could you please give us a timeline, starting with Fidel Castro exiled in Mexico, and then just tell us where Celia Sanchez appears on the timeline and, you know, how she just became part of everything?
Maybe we could go a little bit back. I think that most Cubans have a date, and it's March 10th, 1952, when Batista assumed power, and that means that he came back from Miami, took over the army, he put tanks in the street. And I mean, this was an extremely shocking thing because from about 1948 to 51, the Orthodox Party had been in power and with a very popular leader, Chibas. And the Cubans really had great expectations for reform at the ballot box. And they had already voted in President Sicaros, who had to go into exile when Batista came in. So it was a shock. People were expecting better things of their country than military rule. It took about a year, and Fidel was really, I think, probably the first person to step up and challenge him. And so on July 26, 1953, he and a small band of his followers, who were from the universities mostly, attacked the Moncada garrison. It was kind of a bloodbath. But the country and certainly the young people saw him as being very heroic. And anyway, it was the first step. So he was put in jail, and the people who survived the Moncada were put in jail on the Isle of Pines. And he was released a couple of years later in July 1955 as a general amnesty. Fidel was released. He went to Mexico. And in comes Celia Sanchez. And where I start the book is December 1955, when she is contacted as the person to begin planning for his return to Cuba.
Why did he go to Mexico then if he'd been released?
There were death threats. He and his brother got word that the military had various ways that they were going to get rid of him.
So then you said she was alerted, she was contacted?
Yes, she was contacted because she had been active. She'd been active in politics in the Chibas Orthodox Party, but she also had been active in small kind of revolutionary groups in Oriente province. So she was an organizer and an activist.
How old was she at this time, in December 55?
She was 35 years old.
Mm-hmm. So she was born in 1920.
She was born in 1920. Mm-hmm. She was older than Fidel. She mm-hmm. was older, by a few years older than most of the well-known revolutionaries.
So talk about her. You portray this very remarkable woman, not only just her strength and her dedication, but this ability of hers to organize, to strategize. I mean, basically, she sort of designed and planned and executed much of the revolution. I mean, then there were these women battalions. I mean, I'm just listing all the things that I wrote in my notes about her talents, her communication skills, her ability to do sort of logistics, documenting everything, which then eventually became the National Archive. And then there's also the contradictions. You know, she was a sort of elegant woman and wrote gracious sort of notes to people. And she was fighting in the Sierra Maestra, and she was a guerrilla, and she was a underground person, and she smoked. I mean, all of these things, it's just such a complex picture you paint. So I don't want to say any more. I want you to talk about her as this if you saw her that way, as this very complex person.
No, she's all those things. Celia was never taken for granted from when she was a very tiny child. When she was six, her mother died. And her father really did everything he could to accommodate for the fact that she was sort of a motherless child. Her father was a country doctor, and his practice included lots of people who were cane cutters. And he chose to open his practice to a lot of people who couldn't pay. And so she was very aware of the discrepancy between people. And when she was very young, she tried to help children. She would bring children home and sort of wash them, put them in her own clothes. But she seemed to develop this ability to help people. She saw sort of the bigger picture from the time she was quite young. And her father brought her into his medical office when she was about 12, and she on Saturdays, and she scheduled patients. And so this is the kind of education that boys get, where a father will bring them into his office and give them a job to do. And he also taught her to fish and hunt and do all these things. She didn't go to university. Everyone expected her to go to university. Instead, she became her father's nurse and helper. And in doing that, and he actually relocated near the coast, near the landing, she knew all these different people. That's the whole thing. She was picked out for the landing because she knew everybody.
Just explain what the landing is.
Fidel's return from exile.
So she was picked out to organize that.
And partly because she knew all these people that came to his doctor's office. Mm. She knew their names. She knew how they thought politically. And also, his doctor's office was a vehicle. You know, people could come and pretend to see the doctor and actually come and see her. Mm-hmm. And so she had a very good method for having a revolutionary or a clandestine network of her own.
So but she had the cover of being her father's
yes.
nurse.
She just was very capable. She liked to be a good cook. She had that extra money that comes from being a doctor's daughter. She was able to travel a lot. She went to New York for almost a year in 48.
So she spoke English well, presumably?
Enough. And mm-hmm. she would go to Miami, and she had a little business selling accessories, belts and scarves and things like that. She and a group of women established a hospitality group so that when ships came in, because that's a shipping area, they had events for the sailors to come on shore, you know, the members of the merchant ships that were mm-hmm. coming in to pick up sugar. All those things then she used to her advantage when she was helping out in the revolution.
Was there some transition time? I mean, did she become full-time revolutionary, or was it just always a gradual thing that she was also living two lives, this sort of more genteel?
Well, no, that's a good question. Certainly when my book starts, she keeps that business of hers going in case she needs to get out of the country. She still gives a lot of dinner parties, but they're covers for many things. She does this amazing thing, which is give away toys at the Epiphany, King's Day is what it's called in Cuba. This is kind of a Spanish tradition, but anyway, she'd always done this, or she'd done this, you know, for many years, and she uses that. She uses the continuity of that to move around and contact people.
She personally delivered the toys, so she had face-to-face contact with people?
Plus, she had been doing this for 10 years.
10 years. Hmm.
And so, therefore, she had contacts with, you know, a lot of women who would help her do things, and men who were drivers for the sugar mill there had often helped her distribute toys, because they gave away around 1,000 small, nice toys. And so these men were also people that she could recruit to drive to the coast to help pick up the revolutionaries when they arrived. She had this master plan. She was able to plan the landing, plan contingencies for what would happen if it went wrong. She had that ability to think about, what are these men going to do? They don't know this part of the country.
She was planning for that they would land in a particular place. And then she they not only arrived later than planned, but also in another place. Is that right?
That's right. They ran out of fuel. She planned to have these different trucks and people waiting for them. Mm. The radio was broken or off. The government was expecting them to return, so they had to be very careful. At that point, you know, people really couldn't use telephones and or didn't have them. So she had the whole network of people. And in the end, these farmers that she had recruited were the people who saved Fidel and his men. So everyone was very aware from the very beginning they'd been saved because of Celia. She was very well respected by all the guerrillas. She was on equal footing where most women couldn't have been on equal footing.
The underground were called the clandestinos, is that right? Mm-hmm. So she at some stage, she sort of started getting itchy. She wanted to become a guerrilla. She didn't want to be in the underground. I thought that was really interesting.
She wanted to get out of there always and be in the mountains. You know, very dangerous. Anybody who's in the underground is always in a city, and the police are two steps away. And I think she wanted out for practical reasons, too.
Probably also just wanted the action of being a guerrilla.
I think there's that. And then in Cuban history, there's a tradition, too. The Wars of Independence weren't that. The Second War was in 1895. Her father remembered the Wars of Independence. And there were two famous generals, the Maceo brothers, Antonio and Jose, and their mothers went to war with them. I mean, their mothers ran the camp, for example, did the cooking, the laundry, organized things like that. So there were a fair number of historic women in that part of the country who had been with the Revolutionary Army, the Mambises. And that also, the Mambises, that comes from the period of when the Mariposa flower was worn, very often by women who carried messages rolled up in the stems, and they could go behind the lines.
Well, it wasn't just the Mariposa. I mean, what was also so fascinating about what you write is how these women used their own very feminine clothes to carry messages or do other subterfuge things, right?
The petticoat from the 50s, you know, those, you know, big sort of skirts with lots of, and so they carried all kinds of things,
including
film canisters, guns,
weapons,
everything. But basically, I think that Celia's huge contribution is she had so much self-confidence that she could work with her own network, and she invited women to help her. And so lots of women were able to participate in the war, and they thought about it in those terms. People really wanted to do something to go against Batista and to be part of this movement. And men will often say to me that Fidel gave them an opportunity. You know, they couldn't possibly have been in Batista's army even if they wanted to. It was fairly corrupt. You had to kind of buy your way in, and they didn't really want university people in it, and that he gave them the opportunity to die for their country.
Nancy Stout is talking about One Day in December, her book about Celia Sanchez and the Cuban Revolution. This is Tidings from Hazel Khan on WPKN. So let's talk about your relationship to Celia. I mean, because you present her in these very powerful terms. You know, you make me wish that I could hang out with her. I would love to have known this woman. So when you were doing this work, did she sort of occupy your mind? You know, did you feel you know her? Do you wish you'd known her? Did you like her?
Yes, of course. I certainly have a lot of photographs of her in my apartment and have had for years. She was tough and exacting. Another question is, would she have liked me? She would have been pretty wary of having a North American biographer, and plenty of her family and friends reminded me of that.
She's not only North American, but you said she sort of disdained any personality cult. She didn't want hero worship.
At the same time, I think I came at the right time when people were really old. Her sister especially was very grateful that a biography was being written about her.
Because there never was one in English, right?
No, there is none in English. The Fidel-Celia relationship is such an odd one because they themselves deny that they had a relationship. Let's just back up and say that it was an unbreakable friendship.
But it's not known if they were lovers, or is that just not the kind of question one should even ask?
No, I think it's perfectly reasonable to ask because everybody asks that, and Cubans would even ask me what I'd found out. I was warned very early on to be very careful of asking that question. They did have sex. Let's just put it that way. So do you label somebody a lover, and do you label that for life when she had such a bigger kind of role? So her sister, Flavia, Celia's sister, who was a dentist, and I was so grateful to establish a good relationship, she said, "Nancy, it was neither platonic nor was it romantic." Mm. She gave me a lot of information by saying that. Fidel did rely on her every day in the Sierra Maestra, and he put her in charge of many things that have to do with the war. She was so good for him because, as someone said, she freed him up to win the war. Mm. You know, they came to Havana. You know, he needed to speak to her every day because Che would always sent his messages through Celia, as he had done in the Sierra Maestra. So he not only needed to speak to her because she was telling him what his men in Havana were trying to get in touch with him about, he was just very used to her.
But basically she had this powerful position that you had to go through her to get to Fidel.
That's right. Hmm. Plus she had her hero status because tales of her had been, you know, throughout the nation. So here's a question that is interesting, I think. What would she have gained by being Mrs. Castro? Mm. And I think that if you go back to what we talked about earlier, how she was always interested in the bigger picture, and that means taking on a project, and that can be building buildings or getting all those people from the Sierra Maestra to help them in the war, you know, whatever project she had, or mainly, you know, helping women who were widows or maids who had no form of employment after their employers left and went to the United States. She was very busy doing all of those things. If she were Mrs. Castro, she would have to stand it aside a great deal more, do all those functions. And that doesn't sort of fit with my image of who she is and how she wants to use her time.
She wanted to be his comrade, not his wife, maybe.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And then he also was pretty much a womanizer. Mm. And so how do you handle that? I mean, how is she going to police all the other women? She would have had to deal with that. I don't think she wanted to. I think she felt, certainly in the beginning, that she had the best of all possible worlds. She sort of had the man, she had the status, she had the power. I'm not sure that that was so wonderful all her life, because there's not a man that could touch her.
I see. She could never have a man other than Fidel.
Because nobody would have the courage.
Right, right.
Because he was very possessive of her. She at one point had another floor built on the house, and that was his. And so it made it very comfortable for him to come home. I also feel that she was very, very smart. She established a kind of, field post or comandancia where he could come and feel like Fidel. And I think that the important thing is probably no sex was required. Mm. And that made it very comfortable for him to come. He is actually the one who brought in these children. I had written the book, and then when I discovered these children that they're raised, I had to really redo it and think about it again because it's such an astounding thing. He's the one who really is the homebody. Mm. Seems a very strange thing to explain.
He wanted his refuge, you know, and she provided that. But these children, just explain who these children were.
They were orphans and others, but the first child was in a very dramatic situation of when one of his soldiers was dying, he asked that Fidel take his child right. and raise it. And so Fidel made good on that.
It's very moving, really, that he did that and that they had other children like that, that they were sort of their ersatz children, I suppose. Fidel had children, right, of his own.
Yes. Yeah.
But she never had any children of her own.
No, she never had children.
So, you know, you talk about Flavia, Celia's sister, and other people. Can you just talk a little bit about how you actually did the research for this book? Because what I understand, it took you basically about 10 years, right, to write, and including many trips to Cuba?
Yes.
Did you speak Spanish? Did you learn Spanish? Or?
Well, I've always spoken bad Spanish and, you know, read it as a researcher reads it properly. I think that especially when I was given access to the documents from the archive that Celia herself had created. But the fact is these are the documents of the revolution. These are the messages that were sent during the war back and forth. These are all kinds of very special, you know, documents and letters and orders. And
Celia had the prescience to keep everything. She knew that these were going to be the stuff of history.
She certainly did. And I mean, any librarian, of course, falls in love with her.
And of course, we haven't even said that you are a librarian by profession as well, right?
Well, it's a fairly new profession in the sense that I started it about the same time that I started this. And of course, benefited completely from having access to databases and so on. But getting back to Spanish, I was using their documents, and the worst thing that can happen is when people misinterpret history because they simply don't know. So I brought in a very good translator. In doing that, you start a collaboration. If Argelia couldn't understand certain sets of words, for example, you know, we would realize that they were written 1959 in the Sierra Maestra, in the underground. And we could bring in people who were in her column and say, you know, what does this mean, and so on. So, I mean, it was wonderful to have this ongoing research with someone who was very smart. And then also the Cubans were not worried about writing down about us, how she, you know, because they felt comfortable with the team of us.
They didn't feel that you were sort of North Americans trying to sabotage Cuban history.
Anybody in Cuba who's kind of been there, done that, been part of the government, sort of earns the right to be pretty comfortable.
Mm-hmm. So they felt comfortable with you, but it must have taken you a little while to achieve that comfort.
Yes, years. But on the other hand, over the years, the curator of Celia's papers became very, very interested in what I was doing and some of the questions that I was asking. And the director of the archives was just a fine historian, and he respected what I was doing. It took a long time to get access. I mean, they made requests that I be allowed, and functions like any good archives. They don't let everybody in. You have to go and, you know, tell them what your purpose is and be a scholar or whatever. But because Fidel is so possessive and close to her, he's the one who had to give the final permission, and it took a while. And he finally relented.
One of the things that struck me, one of the many things that struck me in this book, is when you talk about how raw and how emotional it still is, those times in the 50s, you know, during the war. And that when you talk to people, they were still, you know, their emotional responses to talking about it, and how some of them just still don't want to talk about it. Not for political reasons, my feeling was, but somehow it was just a very emotional time when to talk about people who died or been lost their lives in the revolution. Can you talk about that?
I wrote that about Frank Pais, because people did burst into tears or become angry or, you know, various things about Frank. I think that the reason for that is because he was so charismatic and nipped in the bud. I mean, I think that that's it. And he was certainly the other general in the early years of the war. I mean, he was in Santiago planning for Fidel's return. And it was a very, very smart, charismatic person and one of the leaders in the 26th of July movement. You know, Fidel's always been the commander, and he's always had the charisma, and he always was the person who had the original vision. But certainly, if there was a kind of partner, it was Frank Pais during the.
I see.
You know, in the underground.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was, you know, 21 or something like that. And so people do feel very strongly about him. Thalia was an amazing person. She was in the position to really be a fairy godmother, you know, and help people out. So they were grateful and beholden, and then they liked how she managed Fidel and helped him and so on. And then there were also people who were homosexuals that she protected. There's no doubt about that. Mm. That's a very complicated story to tell, so not everybody wanted to talk either.
Right.
And they felt frightened after she died.
Because they lost a protector.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So that's another issue. Mm-hmm. So that's why the emotions are pretty strong.
What is the response to your book in Cuba? Is it available there?
Well, it's just gotten there. I mean, the book's only been out a month and a week, I think. Mm-hmm. And I took it to the Cuban mission here to send to Cuba. Mm-hmm. And so I don't really know yet, but I can tell there's a huge pleasure in just the size and the design of the book. They realize that she deserved it, and it's a big, beautiful book.
It's a 40-page book, and on the cover is a picture of Celia actually with a phone, speaking on the phone. Was that taken at the United Nations or something?
No, that was taken in the Hilton Hotel in New York. It sort of represents all those papers.
Yeah.
You know, that's what she did. Even in when she was young, a friend explained that Celia would sit down at lunch and call people and eat lunch and read the paper at the same time.
And smoke, probably, too, right? Because we didn't talk
probably
about her.
Smoke.
Because we didn't talk about how she died.
She died of lung cancer, and that's a rare picture that she doesn't have a cigarette, you know.
Was it difficult for you to get the book published?
To a certain degree, because many people just don't want to go to Cuba
as a
subject. They didn't think that their house could do it. I'm very happy with the publisher I have.
Talk about the publisher, who the publisher is.
Well, Monthly Reviewer were a bunch of old lefties, so they had no problem. And also, they had very early published Che's first book in the United States, Reminiscence of the Revolutionary War. Mm-hmm. So they saw it as a sort of continuity.
Nice. Also, Alice Walker wrote the foreword. How did that happen?
The publisher wanted to have a foreword. And I mean, we knew that she was interested in the Cuban Revolution. She's always admired Fidel. She likes Cuba. And she really admires women who take risks. And I think she saw that in Celia. To some degree, she saw that in me, too. So, I mean, it's been very positive.
Well, thank you very much, Nancy. I think this is great. I think that people will really benefit a great deal from hearing this story. It's a terrific story. Thank you.
Thank you.
You heard author Nancy Stout talking about her book, One Day in December, Celia Sanchez and the Cuban Revolution, published by Monthly Review Press. This is Tidings from Hazel Kahn. Tidings is heard on the second Wednesday of the month at 7:30 p.m. on WPKN Radio. All Tidings podcasts are archived on hazelkahn.com. Tidings is produced by Tony Ernst.